This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Marketers, are you ready to make an impact with audio advertising? People are hungry for authentic connections in a world buzzing all around us. How do you cut through the noise and truly reach your audience? Visit stateofaudio.com to see Audacy State of Audio, the Trends Report. Uncover the secrets to high-impact creative. Learn how AI is revolutionizing the industry. And get ahead of the curve on measurement and audience trends. Don't just stay in the game. Win it. Visit stateofaudio.com and download your free copy.
Good morning, folks. Hope you had a great weekend. We are headed to the final weekend of Mardi Gras, and everyone's watching the weather, checking to see what it's going to be like this weekend. Big crowds at some of the parades over the weekend as well. A little bit of a weird weather pattern, chilly, then warm, chilly again, kind of damp. So I'm sure that has suppressed some of the crowds that typically go out for the parade. So we'll continue to monitor the weather through the week and make sure that you are updated relative to same. At noon, we'll visit with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll talk about why President Trump dislikes offshore wind. We'll also talk about the crypto hoax that brought down a Kansas bank, the economics of Mardi Gras, and the German election and its consequences, the election of a center-right individual, Friedrich Merz. And he is one who actually looks favorably upon a relationship with the United States, and we'll see what Guy thinks about that. We'll also talk about how the U.S. economy is powered by the richest 10% of Americans. What does that mean? And we'll dig through those numbers as a result of a recent Wall Street Journal article. Elad Inbard, a robotics expert, joins us to talk about manufacturing companies searching far and wide for employees to enter the plants and stay. But many are automating jobs via collaborative robots or cobots in hopes of filling staffing shortages and freeing employees to handle more meaningful tasks, and what this could potentially mean to the economy as well. Romina Bocha joins us, Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. We've tried to get Romina on for a couple of weeks now and finally able to do so. She digs deep into Social Security and the financing problem and how we are going to deal with the resulting debt and whether just growing the economy is enough. She'll tell us why or why not, and we'll talk about that with Romina. You know, there's a lot of controversy. There's been a lot of controversy in this country over immigration policy. And more often than not, I remind folks that as we compare ourselves to other industrialized nations, we are a lot more lenient in our view, in our operation, and in the way that we manage immigrants in this country. And that would be either legal or illegal. The hoops that you have to jump through, the hurdles that you have to jump over in order to gain some kind of legal access to the confines of the borders of this country. Many other countries are a lot more restrictive in doing so. But you know, it's interesting, and I was looking at a series of articles over the weekend as to how different countries are viewing their immigration policy more from an enforcement standpoint. And what I found was a striking similarity to the failures that we have in this country, and how leaders in other countries are saying some of the exact same things, almost the exact verbiage about what we need to do here. As an example, Poland just the other day, I think it was on Valentine's Day, it was either the 14th and the 15th or the 15th, it was the 13th and the 14th. 26,000 police officers, 1,000 border guards swooped in on 32,000 addresses across the country. Now, remember, Poland is a much smaller country than the United States, right? So you got to put these numbers in context. They were looking for 1,474 wanted people. They arrested a couple of hundred foreigners. They deported just under 200. And the border guards also carried out 2,400 checks on the legality of the stay of some migrants that were actually there legally as to whether or not they've overstayed their time period. And they initiated deportation on another 180, actually another 240 citizens. This operation was as the result of Prime Minister Donald Tusk saying that foreign criminals would not be tolerated in their country. Anyone who visits Poland, takes advantage of our hospitality, and brutally violates the law will be deported from Poland, quote unquote. And these crackdowns were kind of the first phase in what the government's campaign and what it would look like out there. Czeslaw Mrozek, the deputy head of Ministry of Interior Administration, said to the local newspaper there that their goal was to significantly reduce the number of people wanted on arrest warrants because the current actions are insufficient. They're staying illegally in our country, and that is why we are increasing the number of checks. In 2024, there were 8,500 foreigners deported. 2,500 of those were Georgians. Of the 7,300 expelled in 2023, 2,700 were Georgians, according to Border Guard data. They have, I think, a coterminous boundary. But General Adam Rapaki, who was the former head of the Ministry of Interior and Administration, said the following: an action-based fight against crime would not yield sufficient results. He said there needs to be a permanent, systemic actions, everyday, ruthless catching of those who are to be sent to prison. The actions may look spectacular, but in the end, they will not scare criminals. He added that convicted foreigners should be sent to prisons in their country of origin so that the Polish taxpayer does not have to pay for them. They go on to say that only systemic, preemptive actions will make it possible to deal with the problem of foreign crime in Poland, which has skyrocketed in the last decade. So these preemptive actions that they're talking about is basically our immigration laws, what we have on the books. You enforce them. And you don't change them. You don't start doing exceptions and exception-based immigration policies based on executive orders or otherwise. You embrace the immigration laws you have on the book, and you enforce them. And if you're going to spend money, you spend money in the system in order to create an adequate throughput so you can deal with the problem in a timely fashion and not get behind the proverbial eight ball, which is where we are in this country. Right now, if you go to immigration court, you may be allowed to stay in this country 5-6 years before you ever get a court date. That's not going to work. And that's the point that they were making in Poland. You have to stay on top of this day by day by day by day. And even their executives are saying it may look ruthless, But that's the only way you stay on top of it, and it's the only way you deal with illegal alien crime within your borders, plain and simple. And obviously, they've had a number of migration issues because of the war in Ukraine and some other countries. And what they're finding is a lot of folks that are coming into their country are creating problems. In fact, they point out that the dynamics of murder committed by Ukrainian citizens in their country alone has increased by 1,100%. The scale of robbery in the case of Georgians that have crossed the border illegally has increased 40-fold, 40x. Such actions, they say, will not improve internal security. Yeah, no kidding. And he also warned that they have a police recruitment problem as well. Is this beginning to sound all too familiar, right? Which would further exacerbate the problem. And they point out if their vacancies nationally reach 25,000, they will in fact lose the ability to ensure security in their country. That is what would be otherwise identified as what? An immigration crisis, right? And you see this in country after country after country, in EU countries after EU country after EU country. The stories are all very similar. For whatever reason, most of these countries around the same time started to take a very lax attitude relative to enforcement. Some actually embraced open borders. Some may suggest that that's why Friedrich Merz has been elected as the chancellor in Germany. Because the reality is that was a big issue in Germany. And he has a very proactive approach to what he wants to see happen there. And you're beginning to see the politics of this change and become very similar to what we're dealing with here in this country. It's interesting because, you know, we label people from all different perspectives that even talk about this. We're racist, we're this, we're that, you know, and we suffer from all kinds of phobias and the whole nine yards. Well, if we do, almost the entire world is. Because when you look at what changes are being made to immigration policies amongst all the industrialized nations, they're changing. And for the most part, it's one recognition point. They can't financially support all these people. Because if they're less than productive, and they're relying on the social networks for assistance from their government, there's a problem. Taxes have to go up. Costs are going up to live in these countries, putting more pressure in economic development that's just simply not there. And they're behind the financial eight ball. They can't afford it. Their schools are overrun. Their health systems are overrun. Socialized medicine is overrun. Benefits from the government is overrun. And they can't figure it out. And the only way that they can shock the system as they see it today is to close their borders, because the migration waves continue to happen each and every day. When the word spreads that you can get into a country, you can apply for benefits, you can get this, you can get that, and everything else, this is not a criticism of the folks coming. They want economic security. And if they can get assistance, whether that be interim or temporary or permanent or otherwise, they'll take advantage of it. They're looking out for the best interests of themselves and their family. And that's why they're migrating. But the real point is how long can this happen and at what cost? And can you continue to support that system without any checks? So when you look at a lot of what's happening in this country today, in the reaction to some of the issues that we've had over the Biden administration, what you're beginning to find are a series of executive orders in an attempt to basically embrace the law. In fact, just this past Wednesday, President Trump signed an executive order to ensure that illegal aliens are not improperly receiving taxpayer benefits. And it was called Ending Taxpayer Subsidization of Open Borders. And it directed all the federal departments and agencies to identify any programs receiving federal funds that provide benefits to illegal aliens and take corrective action as appropriate. Now, this had to deal with a law that was actually on the books that, you know, what we did is we began to do a bunch of workarounds. And this law passed and was promoted under President Bill Clinton. And it was called the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996. It was also known as the Welfare Reform Act. It actually established strict guidelines under which aliens may qualify for benefits. The plain text of the federal law says that it generally prohibits illegal aliens from obtaining most taxpayer-funded benefits. Specifically, 8 U.S.C. 1641 generally limits eligibility for federal public benefits to qualified aliens. Qualified is lawful permanent resident, asylees, refugees, aliens granted parole, and their deportation was withheld. In addition to limiting federal public benefits to qualified aliens, it required most qualified aliens to wait 5 years before they could become eligible to apply for federal public benefits. Now, there were exceptions, right? And over the past 4 years, what the Biden administration did by executive order is they started creating legal loopholes to treat illegal aliens like legal immigrants. And one of the tools that they used to accomplish this was that, and we've talked about this on the show a lot, temporary protected status. And this was, they waved the magic wand, and all of a sudden, you were in legal, you were here, lawful presence. So you could qualify for all these benefits. They knew exactly what they were doing with the lure. They knew exactly how this was going to play out as it relates to numbers. And as there were more and more people lining up at the border, what happened was is that they created other programs to make sure that no one could capture video of what was actually happening at the border so that they could secrete them into this country, wave the magic wand, utilizing temporary protected status, and having them fall under the category of lawful presence. Hence, they started drawing down on the U.S. Treasury. There have been some conservative estimates that it could be as much as $182 billion a year, which is about a $50 billion increase since 2017. That estimate was based on a presence of more than 15.5 million illegal aliens and approximately 5.4 million citizen children of illegal aliens. So that number is about 20 million. You hear that number bandied about every now and again. That burden actually cost Americans approximately $9,000 per illegal alien, which means it's responsible for about $1,000 of your tax bill. Goes directly to fund what's happening here. Remember what the Polish officials were saying, is that you have to be systemic in what you're doing. every day. Take actions. Have consequences. Instill accountability. If any of this is going to make any sense. And it will never make any sense if you begin to create deviations, exceptions, and everything else that far outweigh what the original intent of the legislation was. So it continues to be not only a problem here, you're seeing it in every industrialized nation across the world that are all saying the exact same thing. Enforce the laws that you have on the books. They were put there for good reason in the first place, and there's not a lot that has changed financially or otherwise that calls upon anyone to deviate from that process. Love to hear from you, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line. We'll go to the talk lines when we return. We can talk about anything you'd like, so stay with us. So I always get a lot of texts about the amount of taxes that are paid by the legal community within the state. But there's a flip side to this as well, as it relates to dollars staying here within our economic system. At one point in time, if you took any micro economy, so let's just say New Orleans, for every dollar paid, that dollar would turn over about seven times within the local economy, unless it left in some fashion. And what you see is this overrepresentation in both the illegal and legal immigrant, those that have status here in this country, not necessarily a citizen, in fact, not a citizen. These numbers don't apply to citizens, of what they call remittances. And those are dollars that are sent back to their origin country, right? So 2022 was one of the last reporting periods that it was able to get good data from, because if you know they publish it, then they check it and they double check it, and usually it's about a 2-year lag when you're looking at these types this type of data. So Mexico was the beneficiary of $52.6 billion in remittances from those inside our country. India, $15.8 billion. Guatemala, $14.1 billion. The Philippines, $12.8 billion. China, $12.7 billion. Dominican Republic, $8 billion. Vietnam, $8 billion. El Salvador, $6.7 billion. There was a note, I don't know why, but that $6.7 billion in El Salvador actually represents 7% of their GDP of the entire country. A remittance from El Salvadorans that are here illegally or have some lawful status but not a U.S. citizen. Honduras, $5.9 billion. Nigeria, $5.7 billion. And I would suspect that over the years of the Biden administration, those numbers are probably understated. Just my gut tells me somewhere between 10 to 12% in today's world, based on the number of folks that have crossed the border as it relates to these remittances. So there is a downside to this as well, because we're not the beneficiary of this. And there, in a lot of cases, these are cash payments that, you know, at the local Western Union office, sending back dollars to their origin countries. So when you look at this, there's, you know, on that balance sheet, there's positives, there's negatives to all of this, but there allegedly most people are saying it's a net negative as to where we are. We don't do any economic credentialing. We don't really identify what sectors of our economy that we really need people to work in, and we don't really look at during the process of immigration whether or not immigrant A, B, C, or D fulfill any of those categories. So we're not even aligning our immigration policy to the best interests of the shortages and the deficiencies that we have in our workforce in this country. One would think that that would be our primary motivation, right? That if we're going to allow people in, and we historically have shortages in certain areas, we would want to align that with those shortages and modify our immigration policy to make sure that we put our economy, our national economy, regional economies, local economies, in the best position to succeed. I don't think there's anything wrong with being a little selfish that way. It just makes perfect sense. Instead of these generalized statements out there of, unfortunately, we can't get people to go work our minimum wage jobs, so let's just bring those down here who would are willing to fill those positions, knowing full well that they then become a greater number of those that we call the working poor who can't make ends meet on that amount of money. So they're actually looking for more sustenance from the government, not less, right? As opposed to trying to expand our economy and aligning there, because I know that everyone thinks, well, the agricultural sector, is actually incredibly small overall in this country. And the openings there is an incredibly small number. It's a necessary number, not saying that, but it's an incredibly small number. So what we do throughout all of the economies within our overall economy far outweighs what we would do in the agricultural economy. It would have a greater impact in many respects as it relates to the productivity in this country, as it relates to domestic manufacturing in this country, as it relates to a number of different issues that we are challenged with in this country. And that could be laid with a layer of economic credentialing. That when you come to this country, there are things, there are enormous to you, whether it means a shorter timeline or otherwise, if in fact you bring money, if you bring the means to support oneself. That maybe we should be processing those individuals at a faster pace. Why? Again, selfishly motivated. Filling the voids, quicker entry, accelerated move to becoming citizens in this country. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. It works best for everyone across the board. And maybe it reduces the tax burden or minimizes or diminishes the tax burden, this growing tax burden that we have. That would be a horrible outcome to all of this, right? Where the federal government is not knocking on your door asking for more and more of your income, a greater share of your income to pay in taxes. What a terrible thing. And just maybe if we took this same approach to most everything that we do, we would end up in a better place. We would actually be able to keep more of our money and maybe, just maybe, I don't know, the quality of life in this country would improve. Right? I mean, it's so blatantly obvious in so many different ways. But we have to get off of this mindset that we can be all things to all people, because we cannot. We never have been, quite frankly. We are kidding ourselves when anyone says that. It's not true. We have never been all things to all people. Ever. Life's not fair. They are the haves, the have-nots. It doesn't matter what policy you put in place. It's not going to fundamentally alter any of that. We're going to talk about a topic in the 12 o'clock hour with Guy Williams based on an article that was in the Wall Street Journal this morning. And it's a breakdown of who is really powering the U.S. economy. And it's a certain sector of community of consumers that are really powering it, right? That are moving the needle in our economy. And that needs to change. We need more, not less. This particular study says it's the richest 10%. That's really not that many in numbers, quite frankly. It's alarming how few there are that fall within that category. But it highlights and is emblematic of what I just talked about relative to economic credentialing and aligning our needs in this country from a jobs perspective or productivity perspective as it relates to our immigration policies. You know, we used to talk about smart growth in communities across the country. Not just growth. It had to be smart growth, taking into consideration a number of different circumstances. Same could hold true with immigration. Smart immigration. Smart population growth. Where we get the biggest bang for our buck. Is the juice worth the squeeze? And what you see with industrialized nations today, they're all moving to that model. They recognize that diversity is not necessarily bad. It can be good, but it has to be managed. It has to be managed where it makes sense for the economic sanctity of their country. And it's not just a catch-as-catch-can mentality driven by a chameleon ideology that we can be all things to all people. I can make everybody happy. And typically what you find, no one is. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. So it's amazing how, as a result of DOGE, everyone is writing articles and looking at reports as it relates to the effectiveness of the federal workforce. Others are looking at earmarks that were revived by Congress in 2022, how much that is out there and whether or not that should be maybe the first stop on DOGE is to eliminate earmarks. I think it was eliminated back in the Obama years, if my memory serves me correct. And it's just kind of interesting as to what is happening. And the Washington Post, the author of an article, Andrew Von Dom, talks about our federal workers lazy. Let's look at the data. And interestingly, what they were looking at is how many hours worked, which really is a waste of time to look at that number. Most systems are what are called exception-based systems. They assume that you work 40 hours a week if you're a 40-hour employee, unless you notify the system of something extraordinary. And extraordinary would be you're going on vacation, you're sick, you are part of the family Leave Act. You're having a baby, or you're taking time off for that, or you're caring for an elderly parent, and you're not going to be at work during that period of time. So they go through this article a lot, talking about how many hours are actually worked by the federal government, and the number shows that those within the federal system. Especially when you include the armed services, because when you're in the armed services, you're kind of a good healthy portion of those folks are captured, right? they're assigned to a particular piece of geography somewhere. They're not gone anywhere, right? But they don't talk about what guaranteed overtime there is in some of these programs or otherwise, and they try to compare that to what's happening in the not-for-profit world as well as the for-profit world, you know, where you have a lot of folks that are running hither and yonder, not at one location, a building, sales people that are out and about that are traveling across the country, which again skews the numbers as a result of this exception base. They have a lot more flexibility in going to the doctor or otherwise than most other folks. So, for example, like teachers and, you know, folks like that. So it kind of worked a little bit, works out in the balance, but it was amazing. They didn't talk about productivity at all. And productivity units is what drives all of this. And what's looking at what they're trying to drive with this thought process with DOGE, the fact that you show up for 40 hours a week, that's not indicative of whether or not you are in fact lazy. And in fact, these numbers are even further skewed because most people in the government, if you look at some of the most recent numbers, I think the majority are not back at work. They're working from afar. They're working at home. And unless they are tracking keystrokes on their computers of when they're dialed into the system that they're actually doing something productive or otherwise, they have no real way to measure productivity. And that's where the rubber meets the road. So it's kind of interesting to see all of this as some are trying to defend federal workers, government workers. Others are taking a kind of a middle of the road approach. And then there are others that are focusing in on productivity. What are you producing? At the all-time high, what was your highest productivity rate? You know, things like the retirement system that they found records and they're on a manual process and they're in a cave, right? And I get a lot of nasty text messages. Iron Mountain owns the cave. Obviously, they've climatized it. They've got the humidity systems in there. It's not just a cave. It's one that's utilized by a legitimate company that is in the record retentions business. They are the best in this country. They are a very productive company. It's not a knock on Iron Mountain, right? It's just kind of figuratively speaking in a cave in a manual system. Well, the productivity of that unit doesn't match the input of how many requests are made monthly to process retirement. It's a great place to go look as it relates to how many productive units, how many productive hours within that 40-hour work week, and what is the output of what they're doing. And maybe that would be reflective of what we can assume or expect to see across other similarly type jobs in other federal agencies, because they all do this. They're processing paper. We can find out why we haven't really advanced technologically there. Could it be that we were looking to protect jobs? One has to wonder. Is that what the government is all about, protecting federal government jobs? Or trying to minimize the burden of the taxpayers of this country in financing these very inefficient operations? Maybe it's a very efficient one. I don't know. For a manual process. But should we not look at becoming more efficient? And is it your goal as a taxpayer and your comfort level is, I want to employ as many government employees as possible and I want to pay for them? Really, that's kind of the threshold question, right? We'll be right back. When we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Romina Baccia, Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato. We will dig deep into Social Security.